Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year. Flat. This is Book 11, Chapter 23, and that was me moving the microphone with my nose. From an unfinished house on the Vivarka, the ground floor of which was a dram shop, came drunken shouts and songs. On benches round the tables in a dirty little room sat some 10 factory hands. Tipsy and perspiring with dim eyes and wide-open mouths, they were all laboriously singing some song or another. They were singing discordantly, arduously, and with great effort, evidently not because they wished to sing, but because they wanted to show they were drunk and on the spree. One, a tall, fair-haired lad in a clean blue coat, was standing over the others. His face, with its fine, straight nose, would have been handsome had it not been for his thin, compressed, twitching lips and dull, gloomy, fixed eyes. Evidently, possessed by some idea, he stood over those who were singing, and solemnly and jerkily flourished above their heads his white arm with the sleeve turned up to the elbow, trying unnaturally to spread out his dirty fingers. The sleeve of his coat kept slipping down, and he always carefully rolled it up again with his hand, as if it were most important that the sinewy white arm he was flourishing should be bare. In the midst of the song, cries were heard, and fighting and blows in the passage and the porch. The tall lad waved his arms. "Stop it," he exclaimed, peremptorily. "There's a fight, lad," and still rolling up his sleeve, he went out to the porch. The factory hands followed him. These men, who under the leadership of the tall lad were drinking in the dram shop that morning, had brought the publican some skins from the factory, and for this he had drink served them. The blacksmith, from a neighbouring smithy, hearing the sounds of revelry in the tavern and supposing it to have been broken into, wished to force their way in too, and a fight in the porch had resulted. The publican was fighting one of the smiths at the door, and when the workman came out, the smith, wrenching himself free from the tavern keeper, fell face downward on the pavement. Another smith tried to enter the doorway, pressing against the publican with his chest. The lad with the turned-up sleeve gave the smith a blow in the face and cried wildly, "They're fighting us, lads." At that moment the smith got up, and scratching his bruised face to make it bleed, shouted in a tearful voice, "Police! Murder! They've killed a man, lads!" "Oh, gracious me, a man beaten to death, killed!" screamed a woman, coming out of a gate close by. A crowd gathered round the blood-stained smith. "Haven't you robbed people enough, taking their last shirts?" said a voice addressing the publican. "What have you killed a man for, you thief?" The tall lad, standing in the porch, turned his bleared eyes from the publican to the smith and back again, as if considering whom he ought to fight now. "Murder!" he shouted suddenly to the publican. "Bind him, lads!" "I dare say you would like to bind me," shouted the publican, pushing away the men advancing on him and snatching his cap from his head. He flung it on the ground. As if this action had some mysterious and menacing significance, the workmen surrounding the publican paused in indecision. "I know the law very well, mates. I'll take the matter to the captain of police. You think I won't get to him? Robbery is not permitted to anybody nowadays," shouted the publican, picking up his cap. "Come along then, come along then," the publican and the tall young fellow repeated, one after the other, and they moved up the street together. The blood-stained smith went beside them. The factory hands and others followed behind, talking and shouting. At the corner of the Morris Saker, opposite a large house with closed shutters and bearing a bootmaker's signboard, stood a score of thin, worn-out, gloomy-faced bootmakers, wearing overalls and long, tattered coats. "He should pay folks off properly," a thin working man with frowning brows and a straggly beard was saying. "But he's sucked our blood, and now he thinks he's quit of us. He's been misleading us all the week, and now that he's brought us to this pass, he's made off." On seeing the crowd and the blood-stained man, the workman ceased speaking, and with eager curiosity, all the bootmakers joined the moving crowd. "Where are all the folks going?" "Why, to the police, of course." "I say, is it true that we have been beaten?" "And what do you think? Look what folks are saying." Questions and answers were heard. The publican, taking advantage of the increased crowd, dropped behind and returned to his tavern. The tall youth, not noticing the disappearance of his foe, waved his bare arm and went on talking incessantly, attracting general attention to himself. It was around him that the people chiefly crowded, expecting answers from him to the questions that occupied all their minds. He must keep order, keep the law, that's what the government is there for. "Am I not right, good Christians?" said the tall youth with a scarcely perceptible smile. "He thinks there's no government. How can one do without government? Or else there would be plenty who'd rob us." "Why talk nonsense?" rejoined voices in the crowd. "Will they give up Moscow like this? They told you that for fun, and you believed it. Aren't there plenty of troops on the march?" "Let him in, indeed. That's what the government is for. You'd better listen." "Listen to what people are saying," said some of the mob, pointing to the tall youth. By the wall of Chinatown, a part of Moscow, a smaller group of people were gathered round a man in a frieze coat who held a paper in his hand. "An ukazi. They are reading in ukazi. Reading an ukazi," cried voices in the crowd, and the people rushed towards the reader. The man in the frieze coat was reading the broadsheet of August 31st. When the crowd collected around him, he seemed confused, but at the demand of the tall lad who had pushed his way up to him, he began in a rather tremulous voice to read the sheet from the beginning. "Early tomorrow I shall go to see His Serene Highness," he read. "Serene Highness," said the tall fellow with a triumphant smile on his lips and a frown on his brow, "to consult with him, to act, and to aid the army to exterminate these scoundrels. We too will take part." The reader went on and then paused. "Do you see?" shouted the youth victoriously. "He's going to clear up the whole affair for you, in destroying them, and will send these visitors to the devil. I will come back to dinner, and we'll set to work. We will completely do and undo these scoundrels." The last words were read out in the midst of complete silence. The tall lad hung his head gloomily. It was evident that no one had understood the last part, in particular the words, "I will come back to dinner." Evidently displeased both reader and audience, the people's minds were turned to a high pitch, and this was too simple and needlessly comprehensible. It was what any one of them might have said, and therefore was what an enkazi emanating from the highest authority should not say. They all stood despondent and silent. The tall youth moved his lips and swayed from side to side. "We should ask him. That's he himself." "Yes, ask him indeed." "Why not? He'll explain." Voices in the rear of the crowd were suddenly heard saying, and the general attention turned to the police superintendent's trap, which drove into the square, attended by two mounted dragoons. The superintendent of police, who had gone that morning by Count Rostopchin's orders to burn the barges, and had in connection with that matter acquired a large sum of money, which was at that moment in his pocket, on seeing a crowd bearing down upon him, told his coachman to stop. "What people are these?" he shouted to the men, who were moving singly and timidly in the direction of his trap. "What people are these?" he shouted again, receiving no answer. "Your honour," replied the shopman in the frieze coat, "your honour, in accord with the proclamation of His Highest Excellency the Count, they desire to serve, not sparing their lives, and it is not any kind of riot, but as the Highest Excellency said, the Count has not left. He is here, and an order will be issued concerning you," said the superintendent of police. "Go on," he ordered his coachman. The crowd halted. pressing around those who had heard what the superintendent had said, and looked at the departing trap. The superintendent of police turned round at that moment with a scared look, said something to his coachman, and his horses increased their speed. "It's a fraud, lad. Lead the way to him himself," shouted the tall youth. "Don't let him go, lads. Let him answer us. Keep him," shouted different voices, and the people dashed in pursuit of the trap. Following the superintendent of police and talking loudly, the crowd went in the direction of the Lubyanka Street. "There now, the gentry and merchants have gone away and left us to perish. Do they think we're dogs?" voices in the crowd were heard saying more and more frequently. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. And, well, drinking has commenced. I suppose when you've been left with a whole city to yourself, what else do you do but break into a bar and drink? And then some other people also come into the bar to drink, and then they start fighting. That was really pretty much what happened in this chapter. Being drunk, having fights. And then the police superintendent comes past, and they sort of appeal to him. "Can you help us? Look at this chaos." And he basically just says no. He basically just makes a run for it, doesn't he? He realizes there's no sorting this mess out. They're drunk. They're in a bar. They're fighting. What are you going to do? He was sort of powerless. Kansas 57 said, "What more do we learn about the state of Moscow from this chapter? What social comment is Tolstoy making?" Well, I think maybe the very end of that chapter is the answer there, when these people who were left behind, they're all sort of the lowest members of the society by this point. Well, at first they're getting drunk, looting, going crazy, you know, they've got the run of the city. But at the very end of this chapter, they sort of had this realization, don't they, of like, wait a minute, why are we the only ones left here? And then they start to feel like the wool's been pulled over their eyes. They've been left there to defend the city or to die, essentially. They've just been forgotten and left behind, and the French are about to invade. Kansas 57 also said, "What do you think will come of this situation? How will those remaining in Moscow react to the French entering the city?" You know, I don't know. I really can't predict it. Will they take up arms and rush the French? I mean, surely they're very outnumbered and outgunned, and there's no point in fighting, is there? Will they run? What will they do? I can't actually tell. I don't know if they'll run or they'll fight or some kind of combination of both, or maybe something else altogether. They try to reason with them or run around like chickens with their heads cut off. Chaos might ensue. I'm kind of intrigued, though, to find out. I'm looking forward to reading on. Not much else happened in this chapter, so again, I'm going to do another short podcast. I will do one more little plug for my audiobook. If you want something else to listen to, something a bit different, a fantasy action adventure, you can go and read my first novel as an audiobook for free at anderlewis.bandcamp.com. It's a standalone fantasy novel. You don't get many standalone fantasy novels, do you? Typically, they're part of a longer, ongoing saga, but this is just a one-off book about the length of the first Harry Potter book in word count. And stylistically, it's somewhere around the later end of the Harry Potter books in terms of writing style, when it's a bit darker, but still pretty readable for younger readers. Most of my readers are older, even than myself. What am I saying here? Okay, the cool thing about it being a standalone book in a fantasy world is that the standalone novel lends itself better to an expanded sort of metaphor or allegory. Is that the word I'm looking for? Allegory. Yeah, allegory is the perfect word. It's sort of along the lines of, if you've ever read 1984, it's not similar to that at all. But in the way that 1984 is a sci-fi book, dystopian sci-fi book, but really it's a social allegory disguised as a sci-fi book. I suppose you could say my first book is a little bit of a, not so much a political allegory, like 1984, more like a philosophical, I suppose, allegory, disguised as a fantasy book. Disguised as an adventure fantasy book. The other cool thing about having a standalone fantasy book is that the pacing is much quicker. Fantasy does tend to run at a slower pace, usually just because of the nature of it being a trilogy or a 7-book series or a 13-book series. It does seem to play out quite slowly. This being standalone, it all happens nice and quickly. Let me read you one more review, hey? The use of war elephants in the novel, Missy in particular, was fascinating. But the character portrayal was what really had me invested in the story. Linus is a mere boy who is thrust between a rock and a hard place, and I found it refreshing that he was portrayed as the 13-year-old boy that he was, as opposed to him spontaneously becoming the typical archetypal hero. Also, the plot moved at a good pace and was intriguing. This novel is a great debut novel, and I look forward to future works from this author. That's a review by Lisa. Alright, if I've sold you on that, it's free anyway. andalewis.bandcamp.com. Something else for you to listen to. Thanks for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.